The headlines: Iran says terrorism is a common enemy of all regional countries, urging those countries to adopt a united policy in fighting terror. Another Palestinian succumbs to injuries sustained from Israeli forces' gunfire, increasing the number of Palestinians killed to 5. And Brazil's president says rioters who stormed the government buildings in the capital had inside help. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisu Mishahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Iran has strongly condemned a terrorist bomb attack in the Afghan capital, Kabul, calling terrorism a common enemy of all regional countries. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remarks in a phone call with the Taliban-run Afghan government's foreign minister, Amir Khan Muttaqi. He condoled with the staff of the Afghan's foreign ministry and their families over the attack. The bomb attack, whose main target was Afghanistan's foreign ministry, left several people dead. Amir Abdullahian said terrorists serve the global arrogance and intent to facilitate domination of colonialist countries over the regional states. Iran's top diplomat also urged regional countries to adopt a united policy to fight terrorism. Iran's foreign minister says the Islamic Republic will continue to support the Lebanese people, government, and resistance with full force. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remarks upon his arrival in the Lebanese capital for an official visit. He urged all political groups in Lebanon to elect the country's president through dialogue and agreement. Amir Abdullahian added that political groups in Lebanon are able to choose a president without any foreign intervention. Iran's top diplomat is scheduled to meet with his Lebanese counterpart and the country's prime minister and parliament speaker during his visit. Earlier in our news review program, we delved into excerpts from the remarks of the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, on the recent developments in Iran.
Time now for the news review of this bulletin. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says that enemies made miscalculations when hatching plots to fuel the recent riots and to create disruption in the country. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said that enemies tapped into all of their available resources to plunge the country into chaos and turmoil. He said that they cashed in on people's livelihood issue, as the country's economic situation was not very good. The leader added, among other techniques the enemies employed to stoke unrest were to sneak espionage teams into Iran, to promote Iranophobia worldwide through various propaganda ploys, and to incite ethnic, religious, political, and even personal sentiments. However, Ayatollah Khamenei noted that they failed to pull it off despite all of their schemes because of their miscalculations and Iran's firm resolve. Ayatollah Khamenei made the comments in a meeting with eulogists. Sayyid Mohsen Abbas is a journalist and political commentator joining us from London. Muhammad Ali Araki is also a journalist and political analyst, also joining us from London. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, I'll first start with you. I think it's noteworthy to put into... an approach to this question as to the fact that Iran's leader says the enemy put everything they had in terms of any avenue that they felt that should be channeled in order to, go for their ultimate goal, which I'm guessing would be obviously for a change in the Islamic Republic system. But they failed. Isn't that one way of looking first at what Iran's leader has said?
I think it's fairly evident they failed. Of course, there was a huge occasion, and what their cyber warfare techniques. They used every terrorism technique with all their proxy terrorists surrounding Iran and both internally within Iran as well. They've obviously upped the ante in terms of the economic maximum pressure scenario, which has been going on for, well, decades now. But of course, all of this has failed. The efforts this time, though, were particularly focused, I think, on also using some of the what I call the cultural psychological operations. I think they rather hope that the Iranian youth, the Iranian public, will rebel against the establishment because they prefer what we could only describe as Westoxified morality, Westoxified social and cultural agendas.
Taking a look at some of the channels that were used, Muhammad Ali Araki, do you believe that the way that this was devised was not to use just one, but to use all different avenues, as I mentioned in my first question, which would include the media, which would include the youth, the cultural aspect, throw in the espionage services of different countries, have an international campaign to vilify Iran, which overall is under the Iranophobia umbrella, all at once, with the hopes that this would obviously go for the aim of toppling, perhaps, the government. Which one of these do you think was either ranking high, and overall, why did it fail?
I believe that generally they planned it differently this time. So they had the economical side, the cultural side, and they also had the youth in, and they wanted to get the youth out against, especially the religious scholars. This was something that went on in Iran for a period of time. But I do agree with the fact that the Mahsa Amini events that occurred, it was something completely different. But as usual, they failed, and I expect the same to happen if they attempt to do anything in the future. They will fail again.
Well, that's the whole thing. The idea of how to move forward on the same Mohsen Abbas is, of course, we can't continue this conversation without at least being mentioned how vigilant the security forces and besieged paramilitary forces have actually gone out and put their lives on the line to make sure that law and order is maintained, even though many of them have been killed. I believe there's over 80 at this point, or 82. I'm not sure about the exact amount, but kudos to them, and really hats off to them for putting their lives on the line. But at the same time, do you think that this pressure tactic that the West in general has gone after is going to continue? And what kind of role would Israel play in this whole thing? Because we know what they are after.
I think it is all about Israel. And the bottom line is that the Zionist lobby in Congress, the Zionist lobby, which has a hold on the Anglo-Zionist Imperial Alliance as a whole, dictates the terms and conditions of all the foreign policy, whether it's for Britain, America, or most of the EU now. So I'm afraid Iran has to stay braced for an ongoing, attack on their sovereignty. They have to stay embraced for the fact that the imperialism and the hegemony agenda, which the Americans have enjoyed across the Middle East, will continue. They have to also embrace the fact that their neighbors, who are puppets, the leaders at least, of their neighboring nations, like Saudi Arabia and others, Jordan, Egypt, all of those players in the West Asia arena who are essentially puppets of America and Israel, they will continue to also play a part, because it's from their territories, the territories even in northern Iraq, where the Kurds are again proxies and puppets of Israeli Americans, as well as the Azerbaijanis, as well as Afghanistan. All of these regions have, they have terrorist organizations or operatives which are ready to try to infiltrate Iran. And I'm afraid that is going to continue. The foreseeable future looks at a complete collapse in any of those negotiations regarding the JCPOA and the efforts by the Americans and the Israelis to basically stop Iran from having any access to nuclear development and progress in that region. It will also jeopardize, of course, Iran's economics. And Iran has, of course, the more it's been put under pressure, the more Iran has learned to create what I describe as a resistance economy. So the ability to create its own manufacturing industries, the ability to reach out to the East and the Eurasian axis, the ability to be able to become part of the Shanghai Corporation or the BRICS alliance, the ability to also reject the dollar and to dump the SWIFT mechanism of engaging in finance around the world. All okay. these things are now inevitable. They're happening, and more and more of these things will obviously emerge. And the result will be that America's hold in that region will increasingly decrease.
Thank you. We're going to unfortunately have to end it there. Say Mohsen Abbas. Many thanks, journalist and political commentator. Mohamed Ali Araki, journalist and political analyst, both from London. Thank you to you both. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in.
The Palestinian Health Ministry says another Palestinian youth has succumbed to injuries sustained during an Israeli raid near the West Bank city of Jenin. 18-year-old Abdul Hadi Fakhri Nazal has been hit in the head and neck by Israeli forces live fire in the town of Kaptia. He was taken to hospital in critical condition. Nassau was the second casualty of Israeli forces' assault on the city to arrest Palestinian fighters. Earlier, 25-year-old Habib Mohammed Ikmail died of a wound sustained from the Israeli forces. The new fatalities came after Israeli troops killed 41-year-old Samir Aslan during an overnight raid in Qalandia refugee camp in the occupied Al-Quds. Israeli soldiers have killed 9 Palestinians since the start of the year, including 3 minors.
One more Palestinian was shot dead early Thursday by Israeli soldiers, this time during a raid in Qalandia refugee camp north of Al-Quds. 41-year-old Samir Aslan was killed only minutes after his 17-year-old son Ramzi was arrested by the Israeli soldiers from their home. Aslan, with other family members, went to the roof of their home to watch what was going on, but a sniper shot him in the chest, and soldiers prevented his family members to transfer him to hospital until he died.
A large number of Israeli forces stormed Qalandia refugee camp and detained some 20 Palestinians. Then they headed to the home of the martyr to arrest his son Ramzi. The whole family went up to the roof to see what was happening when they heard loud screams, when an Israeli sniper opened fire and shot Samir directly in the chest.
After Samir was shot, his sons carried him down to transfer him to hospital, but the Israeli soldiers dragged him and put him on the ground and prevented anyone to rescue him. They left only after they made sure Samir succumbed to his injuries. This is a field execution.
Samir Aslan is the third Palestinian killed in the occupied West Bank in the last 24 hours. Israeli forces killed 18-year-old Sanat Samamri following an alleged stabbing attack in the southern occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil. On Wednesday, 21-year-old Ahmed Junaid was shot dead in the head during a military raid on the Balata refugee camp in Nablus, north of the occupied West Bank.
The continuation of these raids and campaigns means that this current Israeli cabinet will continue the aggressive policies against the Palestinians in a bid to resistance and prevent any form of activity in the occupied West Bank.
Tensions have been running high in the occupied Palestinian territories since last year. Nearly 180 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank alone in 2022. The United Nations said death toll was the highest since 2006 in the occupied West Bank. The Israeli military's brutality shows no sign of abating and is cracking down on Palestinian fighters as well as the general population here. Palestinians warn of even more aggressive policies by Israel's current right-wing regime led by Benjamin Netanyahu. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
The Brazilian president says rioters who took part in the Sunday attacks on government buildings in the capital had inside help. Lula da Silva pointed the finger at, quote, conniving agents from the police and armed forces.
I am convinced that the door of the Planalto Palace was open so that these people could enter because there was no broken door at the entrance. That is, it means that someone facilitated their entry here. We're going to investigate and see what happened.
The president said he had ordered a thorough review of the presidential palace staff. The mop-up operation comes after backers of former far-right President Jair Bolsonaro stormed the presidential palace. Congress and Supreme Court, the storming of the government buildings was aimed at overthrowing Lula's government a week after he took office. They looted government offices, destroyed priceless works of art, and left graffiti messages calling for a military coup. Nearly 2,000 rioters have been arrested and more than 1,100 put under continued detention. A poll published on Wednesday said 93% of Brazilians condemned the Sunday's violent riots. Peru's a weeks-long protest continues unabated, forcing the government to close the airport of the country's tourist city of Cusco. Peru's transportation ministry said the main airport in Cusco has been closed as a preventive measure. The decision was made after civilians attempted to enter the airport after setting fire on a bus station and blocking train tracks. Supporters of the ousted President Pedro Castillo have been barricading streets around the country. They are demanding new elections and the removal of the current President Dina Boluarte. Castillo has been remained in custody by the court for another 18 months, charged with rebellion. Violent protests have also left 42 people dead and hundreds injured. 17 fatalities happened in the southern Puno region alone. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
To Palestinians and their allies, U.S. hypocrisy is palpable. The United States selectively criticizes some countries for their human rights violations, but pointedly ignores the Zionist regime's illegal occupation of Palestinian territory and its commission of war crimes and crimes against humanity against the Palestinian people. 2 years after launching an investigation of war crimes committed by the Zionist regime in Palestine, the ICC is still dragging its feet because of U.S. pressures. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned, please. The website of Truth Out wrote, nearly 2 years have passed since the International Criminal Court, ICC, began investigating war crimes committed by the Zionist regime in the occupied West Bank, including East Al-Quds and Gaza. But the ICC has yet to take concrete steps to move the investigation forward. Frustrated with the glacial pace of the ICC's investigation and the lack of clarity about how and when the investigation will proceed, three Palestinian human rights organizations issued a joint statement to the Assembly of States parties to the Rome Statute, the management body of the ICC, on December 6, saying, "We have not seen any concrete step in this investigation. No action by the prosecutor to break the vicious cycle of impunity." They added, "The situation on the ground is deteriorating year after year, month after month, day after day. We feel that we have been left alone in our struggle, and Palestinian victims are losing hope. The initial news of the ICC investigation came on March 3, 2021, when Fatou Bensouda, then chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court ICC, announced the opening of a formal investigation into war crimes committed by the Zionist regime in the West Bank, including East Al-Quds and Gaza Strip, during and since the Zionist regime's 2014 Operation Protective Edge, which killed 2,251 Palestinians. Following a five-year preliminary examination, Bensouda found a reasonable basis to believe that Israeli regime forces had committed the war crimes of willful killing, willfully causing serious injury, disproportionate use of force, and transfer of Israelis into Palestinian territory. Bensouda also found there was a reasonable basis to investigate possible war crimes by the Zionist regime forces, including intentional attacks against Palestinian people. The three Palestinian human rights organizations that issued a joint statement this month to raise concerns about the lack of progress in the ICC investigation are the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, a group that protects human rights and promotes the rule of law in accordance with international standards, Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights, a group that protects human rights, especially economic, social, and cultural rights, in the occupied Palestinian territory, and Al-Haq, which documents human rights violations in the occupied Palestinian territory. In 2021, the opening of an investigation by the prosecutor was perceived as a huge leap forward, the groups wrote in their joint statement. After years of frustration, we hope that it was the start of a new era of accountability for the grave crimes committed in the occupied Palestine. This year alone, the three groups added, more than 200 Palestinians, including many children, were killed by Israel's settler colonial regime in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. The Palestinian human rights organizations noted that beloved Palestinian Al Jazeera journalist Shirin Abu Aghaleh was assassinated in cold blood by an Israeli sniper in broad daylight, and six prominent Palestinian civil society organizations, including Al-Haq, were shut down after being falsely designated as terrorist organizations. In spite of these events, the three organizations wrote the ICC's Office of the Prosecutor hasn't issued a single statement concerning Palestine. They contrasted the ICC's prosecutor inaction on Palestine with the situation of Ukraine, about which the Office of the Prosecutor has been very proactive. It is also crucial that the same level of attention, activity, and resources is applied to other situations, including Palestine, to avoid perceptions of selectivity and politicization, the groups wrote. Victims should not be competing for justice, and double standards should not have a place in justice, they said. Truth Out wrote in this regard, on November 21st, Bezalel Smotrich, head of the Zionist regime's far-right religious Zionism party, called Palestinian human rights organizations an existential threat to Israel. He said that the incoming Israeli regime government must take legal and security measures against them, including seizing their funds. 2 days later, 198 Palestinian regional and international civil society organizations, including the National Lawyers Guild, Center for Constitutional Rights, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and International Association of Democratic Lawyers wrote an open letter to Chief ICC Prosecutor Karim Khan, decrying missed opportunities for preventive statements in the past year. The CSO cited the Zionist regime's killing of Palestinians without clear provocation, as well as raids and assaults against worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque and at Haram al-Sharif in occupied East Al-Quds. Three of the six designated terrorist organizations, the CSOs noted, have been providing the ICC Prosecutor's Office with information about serious crimes committed by Israeli nationals within the jurisdiction of the court. The CSOs cited the Apartheid Convention, which lists as an inhuman act of apartheid the persecution of organizations and persons by depriving them of fundamental rights and freedoms because they oppose apartheid. The CSOs wrote that, although Israel's targeting of these organizations could hinder the work of the ICC, there has been no public reaction by your office. The CSO urged the Office of the Prosecutor to publicly condemn and call on Israel to rescind the terrorist designations, publicly affirm that the Office of the Prosecutor will scrutinize Israel's crimes during its unprovoked military offensive in August 2022, urgently expedite the ICC investigation into the situation of Palestine, including the crimes committed against humanity of apartheid and persecution, and finally, issue preventive statements to deter the Zionist regime's crimes against humanity and war crimes. The Zionist regime's Prime Minister-designate Benjamin Netanyahu is assembling Israel's most extreme right-wing government to date. Attorney Diana Bhutto, former advisor to the negotiating team of Palestine Liberation Organization, wrote in an op-ed in New York Times, Netanyahu's government will likely be receptive to Smotrich's suggestion to persecute Palestinian human rights organizations even more severely than the prior government that designated them terrorists and shut down their offices. Moreover, the chief enabler of the Zionist regime's illegal occupation of Palestinian territory, the U.S. government, which annually provides the Zionist regime with $3.8 billion in military aid, is implicitly exerting pressure on Khan to drag his feet on the ICC investigation of the Zionist regime crimes. When U.S. President Joe Biden visited Al-Quds in July, he and the Zionist regime Prime Minister Yair Lapid concluded an agreement affirming they would continue to work together to combat all efforts to unfairly single Israel out in any forum, including at the UN or International Criminal Court. Although the United States refuses to join the ICC, it has consistently tried to undermine it, expressing serious concerns about the ICC's attempts to exercise its jurisdiction over Israeli regime personnel. But on March 15th, 100 U.S. senators, who find it difficult to agree on anything, unanimously passed SR 546, which encourages member states to petition the ICC or other appropriate international tribunal to take any appropriate steps to investigate war crimes and crimes against humanity committed by other countries. To Palestinians and their allies, U.S. hypocrisy is palpable. The United States selectively criticizes some countries for their human rights violations, but pointedly ignores the Zionist regime's illegal occupation of Palestinian territory and its commission of war crimes and crimes against humanity against the Palestinian people. Opponents of the Zionist regime's crimes should register their strong opposition to the U.S. enabling of the Zionist regime's oppression of Palestinians, both to their Congress members and the White House. As long as the U.S. regime receives no significant pushback, it will continue to facilitate the Zionist regime's illegal occupation and violate the human rights of the Palestinian people. People can also join the boycotts, divestment, sanctions movement to end international support for the Zionist regime's oppression of Palestinians and pressure the fabricated regime of Israel to comply with international law. According to Middle East Monitor, almost 200 Palestinian and international organizations representing civil society have called on the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, ICC, Karim Khan, to investigate the allegations of war crimes committed by the Zionist regime against Palestinians. Wafa has reported. The resident of the Assembly of States Parties to International Criminal Court, Silvia Fernandez do Gurmendi, was included in the memorandum submitted to the court. The signatories called for public condemnation of the Zionist regime's designation of Palestinian civil society organizations as terrorist organizations and urged the Israeli regime to reverse it. They also demanded that the crimes committed by the occupation regime during its unjustified military attack on Gaza Strip in August 2022 be included in the ongoing investigation into the situation in Palestine. Moreover, they stressed the need to speed up the investigation, which should include crimes against humanity such as apartheid and persecution, as well as the need to issue proactive statements to prevent Israeli regime actions that could contribute to the continuation of such crimes. The groups added that all of the crimes committed in Palestine, including persecuting Palestinian organizations, should be investigated by the ICC according to Article 9 of the Rome Statute.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and on the eve of the blessed birthday anniversary of the Holy Prophet's Immaculate Daughter, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her, let us hear some interesting words from this Lady of Light about the purpose of creation by God Almighty. He originated things, but not from anything that existed before them, and created them without examples to follow. Rather, he created them with his might and dispersed them according to his will. Not for a need did he create them, nor for a benefit for him did he shape them, but to establish his wisdom, bring attention to his obedience, manifest his might, lead his creatures to humbly venerate him, and to exalt his decrees.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
This is the show A to Z. For today's program, Brother Muhammad is going to talk to us about Islamic education. Stay tuned.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's discussion with regards to Islamic education, we would like to look at an important aspect of an Islamic lifestyle, and that is worship of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Indeed, worship of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is what defines a Muslim from another person. But Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has specific acts of worship for the Muslim that will assist the Muslim in getting closer and gaining the proximity of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Out of these acts, one of them, and one maybe the most important of them, is the prayer. That is the daily prayer called Salah. Indeed, Salah is such an act that itself it requires attention and an awareness of its components, its requirements, its etiquettes, and its conditions. And therefore, a person who needs to be taught and nurtured into Salah needs to have all of these details taught and educated to him slowly and gradually. We find that the Holy Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam would focus a lot on practical demonstrations when it came to Salah. And not only Salah, even the preconditions of Salah, such as wudu and tayammum, or even other acts of worship like Hajj. And we have traditions from the Imams that one of the companions of the Imams came to him and he asked him about tayammum. An imam struck his two hands, the palms on the ground, and dust attached to it. And that is what he used to wipe his forehead and his face. And with the same hands, he wiped the outer side of his two hands, the right and the left. And this is how tayammum is done. And the imam did not just tell him verbally how to perform tayammum. Rather, he showed him how to do tayammum. Likewise, Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, in the final and farewell hajj that he performed in the last year of his life, he told the Muslims, خُذُوا عَنِّي مَنَاسِكَكُمْ, take your manasik, your acts and rituals of hajj from me. And that is when whatever Rasulullah would do and howsoever he would perform the acts, the Muslims would watch him carefully and they would follow exactly how he would do the different acts of hajj. And indeed, hajj is an act that is something that can be learned and experienced through practice as well. And in certain countries, we find that even to train the Hujjaj before they go for their pilgrimage, Hajj, they actually have models of the Kaaba and Safa and Marwa and Arafat and so on in place, such that these Hujjaj who are preparing for their once-in-a-lifetime journey of Hajj, they are well prepared by doing the practical demonstration and doing a practical exercise in learning how to do the acts of Hajj. And indeed, as parents as well, as educators, as individuals who are responsible for training our children in the Islamic acts of worship, indeed, we must use practical demonstrations as a very important tool and strategy when it comes to training our children, training our children into different acts of worship. Indeed, the practical aspect is one that will create that awareness and will transfer a lot of the details that we may or may not be able to communicate through verbal teaching and instruction. I hope you enjoyed today's discussion. Until next time, fi amanillah, under God's protection.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
In mid-December, the White House and U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders clashed in the run-up to a Senate vote on the War Powers Resolution put forward by the Vermont Independent. Sanders' resolution would have put a definitive end to U.S. support for the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen by ending sharing intelligence for the purpose of enabling offensive coalition strikes and also ending logistical support for offensive coalition strikes, including providing maintenance and spare parts for Saudi fighter jets. But by the evening, Sanders had agreed to withdraw his resolution, saying he would enter negotiations with the White House on compromise language. The Intercept revealed that the White House was pressuring senators to vote against the bill, and the Democrats came out in opposition to Sanders' resolution. Sanders' justification for not holding the vote was that the Biden administration claimed it would work with Congress on ending the war in Yemen. But even if the White House really wants to engage with Congress on the issue, or if Sanders chooses to reintroduce the resolution, the plan will take time, which Yemenis don't have. A similar Yemen War's Powers resolution was passed in 2019 by both the U.S. House and Senate.
U.S. intervention in Yemen is unauthorized, unconstitutional, and immoral. And we must not, we cannot delay voting to end our involvement and our support of Saudi Arabia any further. If we do, we have ourselves to blame for our country's lost credibility on the world stage. And more importantly, our own consciences will bear the blame for the thousands of lives that will surely continue to be lost.
It is a vote to demand that the humanitarian crisis in Yemen be addressed. It is a vote that will tell the despotic dictatorship in Saudi Arabia that we will no longer be part of their destructive military adventurism.
However, the administration of former President Donald Trump vetoed the bill. The Biden administration's opposition marks a reversal on the part of top Biden administration officials, including Jake Sullivan, Samantha Power, Susan Rice, and Wendy Sherman, who signed a letter in 2019 calling on Congress to override then-President Donald Trump's veto of the Yemen War Powers Resolution. Anti-Yemen war advocates say now it is the ideal time to put forth the resolution, as the UN-brokered truce in Yemen has expired more than 2 months ago, and the Saudis can resume airstrikes at any time. Since the onset of the war in 2014, the Saudi-led coalition has launched a wide-ranging aerial bombing campaign, carrying out thousands of airstrikes. The coalition also imposed an economic blockade on Ansarullah-controlled areas, including a sea and air blockade,
worsening economic conditions for millions of Yemenis. More than 23.4 million people, including 12.9 million children, are in need of humanitarian assistance and protection, almost three-quarters of their entire population. The previously announced end to U.S. offensive support did not prevent devastating and indiscriminate Saudi airstrikes in Yemen, which occurred as late as March 2022. More than 11,000 children have been killed or maimed as a result of the war, according to UNICEF. Critics say the White House's opposition to the war powers resolution is, in fact, a gift to the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. In the words of Abdullah Al Aoud, research director for Saudi Arabia and the UAE at Democracy in the Arab World Now, despite the catastrophic failure of Biden's fist-pump approach with MBS and the Saudi government, it seems that while MBS gets more brutal and emboldened, the administration doubles down on protecting him. The fact is, the American government has protected bin Salman legally in U.S. courts with a legal immunity request, protected him militarily with weapons and arms sales, and protected him politically with pressure on Congress to impede efforts to end the Yemen war. For three presidential administrations now, the U.S. has provided weapons and logistical support to the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. The United Nations estimates that 233,000 people have died in Yemen during the war, more than half of them due to non-combat factors like food insecurity and poor medical care. U.S.-made weapons have been used in attacks that left hundreds, if not thousands, of civilians dead and have helped keep the war raging for nearly eight deadly years. In his first visit to the State Department as president, Biden said he was ending U.S. support for the Saudi-led campaign in Yemen.
This war has to end. And to underscore our commitment, we are ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
But by December 2021, the administration had pushed an additional sale of missiles to Saudi Arabia through Congress. Biden administration officials have failed to condemn Saudi airstrikes at critical moments and haven't effectively pushed Riyadh to end the blockade that's keeping humanitarian aid away from civilians.
The president welcomes today's announcement of an extension of the truce in the Yemen conflict. The truce in Yemen, of course, was a key agenda item during the president's visit to Saudi Arabia, where he met with the king and the crown prince and with leaders from across the region. We're grateful for the leadership of Saudi Arabia throughout this truce process, as well as for the Sultan and leaders of Oman, who have also played an important role throughout. Now, this truce is now going on 5 months, has brought a period of unprecedented calm in Yemen, saving thousands of lives and bringing tangible relief for countless Yemenis. 5 months, which may not sound like a lot, but when you're talking about 7 years of war, thousands and thousands of Yemeni lives, it counts for a lot. And now we have a chance to extend this another 2 months.
On these grounds, it's quite understandable why the Yemenis are so cynical about the goodwill of the Americans when they promised to work out a truce or ceasefire that would benefit Yemen in the face of the Saudi-led aggression.
The Biden administration has had 2 years to do what he promised with regard to Saudi Arabia and Yemen. The only tangible measure it has taken so far is making Sanders withdraw from his anti-war resolution. It's naive to suppose that the Americans will lift a finger to put pressure on Saudi Arabia to end the bloodiest war ongoing in the world.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
There are reports that CIA-backed units killed hundreds of Afghan civilians in brutal night raids. According to reports, Zero units backed by the US made virtually no effort to distinguish non-combatants and killed with total impunity. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. Without citing ProPublica wrote in this regard, in 2019, reporter Lindsay Billing returned to Afghanistan to research the murders of her mother and sister nearly 30 years earlier. Instead, in the country's remote reaches, she stumbled upon the CIA-backed Zero units who conducted night raids, quick, brutal operations designed to have resounding psychological impacts while ostensibly removing high-priority enemy targets. So, Billing's attempt to catalog the scale of civilian deaths left behind by just one of four Zero units, known as the Zero Two, over a four-year period. The resulting report represents an effort no one else has done or will ever be able to do again. Here is what she found. At least 452 civilians were killed in 107 raids. This number is almost certainly an undercount. While some raids did result in the capture or death of known militants, others killed bystanders or appear to target people for no clear reason. A troubling number of raids appear to have relied on faulty intelligence by the CIA and other U.S. intelligence gathering services. Two Afghan Zero Unit troops describe raids they were sent on in which they said their targets were chosen by the United States. The former head of Afghanistan's intelligence agency acknowledged that the units were getting it wrong at times and killing civilians. He oversaw the Zero units during a crucial period and agreed that no one paid a consequence for those failed raids. The Afghan soldiers weren't alone on the raids. U.S. Special Operations Forces soldiers working with the CIA often joined them. The Afghan soldiers Billing spoke to said they were typically accompanied on raids by at least 10 U.S. Special Operations Forces soldiers. These deaths happened at our hands. I have participated in many raids. one of the Afghans said, adding, and there have been hundreds of raids where someone is killed and they are not Taliban or ISIS, and where no militants are present at all. Military planners baked potential collateral damage into the pre-raid calculus. How many women, children, non-combatants were at risk if the raid went awry, according to one U.S. Army Ranger Billing spoke to. Those forecasts were often widely off, he said, yet no one seemed to really care. He told Billing that night raids were a better option than airstrikes, but acknowledged that the raids risked creating new insurgent recruits. You go on night raids, make more enemies, then you gotta go on more night raids for just some of the enemies you now have to kill, he said. Because the Zero units operated under a CIA program, their actions were part of a classified war, with the lines of accountability so obscured that no one had to answer for operations that went wrong. And U.S. responsibility for the raids was quietly muddied by a legal loophole that allows the CIA and any U.S. soldiers lent to the agency for their operations to act without the same level of oversight as the American military. And congressional aides and former Intelligence Committee staffers said they don't believe Congress was getting a complete picture of the CIA's overseas operations. Lawyers representing whistleblowers said there is ample motivation to downplay to Congress the number of civilians killed or injured in such operations. By the time reports get to congressional oversight committees, one lawyer said, they are undercounting deaths and overstating accuracy. U.S. military and intelligence agencies have long relied on night raids by forces like the 02 unit to fight insurgencies around the globe. The strategy has again and again drawn outrage for its reliance on sometimes flawed intelligence and civilian death count. In 1967, the CIA's Phoenix program famously used kill capture raids against the Viet Cong insurgency in South Vietnam, creating an intense public blowback. Despite the program's ignominious reputation, a 1971 Pentagon study found only 3% of those killed or captured were full or probationary Viet Cong members above the district level. It appears to have served as a blueprint for future night raid operations. Story of the Sky.
Part 2.
From 3,500 years before the birth of Jesus Christ until the late 20th century, about 14,500 wars have broken out and over 3 billion people have lost their lives due to wars. Only 300 years of history of mankind